This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The Netflix series Dear White People looks at racism on a college campus. The show explores the lives of African-American students at a fictional Ivy League school called Winchester University. One of the main characters uses her socially conscious and unapologetic radio show to talk about being black at a mostly white institution.
Dear white people, here's a little tip. When you ask someone who looks ethnically different, what are you? The answer is usually a person about to slap the out of you.
That's a clip from the new Netflix series, Dear White People. The program has received acclaim and criticism for its exploration of race, and one of the many things we'll talk about today in this month's installment of Back Channel, Connecting Culture and Context. Joining me, as always, are Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark's a professor of African and African-American studies at Duke University and the author and host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark.
How you doing, Frank?
I'm doing well. Natalie Bullock Brown, professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Welcome back, Natalie.
Thanks, Frank.
Let's talk about this series we briefly described in the intro, Mark. Give us a deeper look at the show, Dear White People. Tell us what it's about.
So it began as a film a few years ago, and I might add a not very good film, that I think really didn't take seriously the kind of microaggressions and experiences that black college students have on campus. And I think for older generations of people in which there was really no language to even support our presence at PWIs, you know, 25 or 30 years ago, I think a lot of us disregarded it. The series is much better, much sharper, much critical, much more entertaining. And I think it does capture the range of experiences of what it is to be a black student at historically white universities and colleges, and navigating that not just in terms of the black-white dynamic, but also in terms of the diversity within blackness. Mm-hmm. There's this great scene, you know, early in the series where the black coalition meets, and you have all these specific, you know, the Black Student Union, the African American Student Union, the Black Forum,
right?
And so that's not unusual, right? In terms of what we see on campuses these days.
Well, and the title itself, Dear White People, sounds like it's addressed directly to white people, but along the lines of what Mark was just saying, this is about a conversation within African-American communities, is it not, Natalie?
I think so. I mean, it definitely is complicated by the fact that it's located in this predominantly white space. But yeah, I think that the conversations that we see in Dear White People between the black characters are really no different than what you would find on the campus of a historically black college or university. And I think that's what makes the series really interesting because, just like Mark described, we have all, you know, it really sort of drives home the idea that black people are not a monolith, that there are so many different manifestations of who we are. And some of those overlap, some of them don't. But it's important, I think, to understand that, you know, black people are, even though our experiences in many ways are, we share a lot of them in common, at the same time, you know, we absolutely bring different perspectives to similar problems.
And what about the idea that this is not the first time that movies have sort of made their way to Netflix? This idea that maybe a series, because, you know, it can be many, many more hours than a movie, can allow a little more depth and a little deeper context than the original film, which, as Mark suggested, didn't play to much acclaim.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, first of all, I should say that I did not see the original film. And when I went to Netflix and found Dear White People, I thought it was the film and didn't realize it was a series. But the series, I mean, Mark is absolutely right. It is so engaging and entertaining. I mean, I pretty much binge watched it one weekend with my son because there's so much going on and you want to pick up and see what happens next. And I think a series is really important. In that way, because it is able to dive deeper and get to the complexities.
It has allowed them, unlike the, you know, film in a shorter period of time, they've been able to serialize an event. And I think very wisely, there's always this kind of going back to this signature moment at the beginning. And I think that allows us to get some depth around the characters, around some of the structures in which they're trying to deal with. So I think it's just done much better than the film was.
Yeah. Give you a little sense of the show. It largely revolves around the relationship between black students and white students, certainly at this university. And we did play a clip of the main character, Samantha White's radio show. Let's hear another clip now that features some of the responses to her show.
I just want to say that I find your show offensive and highly divisive. We need to come together at times like this.
Are you a white male?
Why? Race is a social construct.
I'll take that as a yes. Look, I didn't create the divide. I'm just calling attention to it.
Dear white people, even you have to admit your show comes off aggressive.
Dear white people is a misnomer. My show is meant to articulate the feelings of a misrepresented group outside the majority. I get it. The realization that you contribute to a racist society can be unsettling, but you sound like a grown-ass woman to me. Next.
That's a clip from the Netflix series Dear White People, talking with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal, who joined me for another installment of Back Channel. So what about this kind of backlash, the idea that this will only make things worse? It's a little aggressive. It's a little in your face. You know, this doesn't promote dialogue.
I think it's important that she's attempting to have a conversation, right? The title of the radio show is not Damn White People. it's Dear White People, right? Trying to draw them in some way, but also, you know, doing it in a way that's unfiltered, right? You know, that if we're going to actually have this conversation, we have to have some real talk. I have to be able to do this in a way that's unfettered and unfiltered so you can really understand the dynamics of the rage and alarm experience. And you know, most young white folks, you know, if they've grown up in situations where they haven't had regular interactions with African Americans, it's important for them to hear these kinds of narratives because it's countering these other perceptions of blackness that they get through mainstream media.
Right. And I think, you know, that first caller who suggests that Samantha's show is divisive, I mean, that's a reflection of the larger culture. I mean, that's what we hear around just the mere presence of a black president in the White House. So, you know, it really sort of emphasizes and underscores what we're already dealing with on a larger scale.
And it seems to me this kind of myth, and maybe it's an all-American fantasy, that somehow you can get to the joy of sitting around having a beer together without the pain of acknowledging what's wrong and sort of having to say it all out loud and getting through that very difficult territory. And then maybe after that conversation, have a beer together.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right, Frank. I think the point of Dear White People is to say that, you know, let's not pretend that this thing is not the elephant in the room. Let's deal with it, get it out of the way if we can, and then move on.
Well, let's talk about or listen to Justin Simeon, who is the creator and writer of the show, talk about what he had in mind a little bit when he talked to the host of NPR's All Things Considered last month.
I think if it was yo white people or hey white people or, you know, F you white people, you know, I could see that. But to me, dear anything is an invitation to a conversation. That's what that sort of just in a language on the page kind of way, that's what that implies. And I hope that as you watch the series, it begins to take on different kinds of meanings. You know, I think that there are characters who feel like they're constantly in response to white people, like they are constantly having to dear white people in their everyday lives. I hope that people see it as a conversation starter, not as sort of a way of being shut out of a conversation.
Justin Simeon on NPR's All Things Considered last month, the creator and writer of the new Netflix show, Dear White People. I'm talking to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal today on Back Channel. And as you say, the conversation also gets into some of the depth and complexity. I want to get to another scene in the program. Here's a scene where Gabe, one of the characters, meets Reggie. Reggie, a member of the Black Student Union, with Samantha, and they're talking about a blackface party that recently took place on campus.
Man, I just, you know, in 2017, I can't believe something like this can happen.
Really? Because I can. I mean, it's almost like you and I attend two totally separate schools.
Hey, man, I'm just as as you are.
Not possible.
No, yeah. Look, that's not what I meant. I meant, you know,
Look, bro, just because you got a black chick on your arm doesn't mean you get to Miley Cyrus our pain, all right?
Reggie, chill.
No, look, you're absolutely right. I have no idea how you feel, but I want to. Look, I'm Gabe.
Why are you even here?
I mean, what are you gonna do, you gonna hit me?
It might surprise you, but I don't use my fist to solve problems. hit you. Nigga, I should hit you for thinking that I would hit you.
And that's a clip from the Netflix series, Dear White People. I'm talking to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. What about that? That's a very challenging conversation in the sense that, to some extent, I feel that in order for us to have this conversation, I should make some effort to put myself in your place, to feel the pain or to somehow try to understand it. And yet you can run afoul very quickly, pretending to already be there.
You know, when we think about, for instance, young black and white males, college age, their connections very often are very superficial, right? Substantive on some level, but superficial. So they play basketball together. They might play football together. They might be on some sort of athletic team together. They might bond over desire, or the desire over women in some sort of context, but they're not really having these conversations, right? And because the framing of this conversation is about both of their affections for this particular black woman, right, you see a certain kind of tension that's there, right? Because they don't share the same space. The young white man has a kind of freedom, what we say privilege all the time, you know, to be able to go and to freely flow through the campus in ways that we see later in the series that Reggie can't. But yet, you know, you have a young white male character who is committed to being part of this space, who wants to know. And that's a very difficult conversation, right? Because on the one hand, if you're a young African-American student in this situation, you're very protective of the social space that you've created as a haven, right? As a safe haven from the campus, right? So you don't want that space encroached. But at the same time, you need allies, right? But the context is like, and what is the context in which we're going to allow these allies to be able to function in the ways that they need to function?
Right. And I think Gabe is, you know, he models sort of the what I think in the age of Black Lives Matter, what we would hope that white people would bring to the conversation, which is a humility, a desire to learn more, a desire to listen more than speaking. And, you know, Gabe tries. He tries to say, you know, I get it. I'm trying to understand, but as you said, he quickly runs afoul.
Back Channel continues on the State of Things in just a moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest, popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal, here with another installment of Back Channel, connecting culture and context. We're still talking about the new Netflix series, Dear White People, and the show highlights the relationship between African-American students and the university administration. I want to play a clip here of the character Lionel at a town hall meeting in the show. And here he is challenging officials who are considering getting rid of the black dorm on campus.
Lionel Higgins, sophomore. Just a quick question for President Fletcher. How much money are we worth to you?
Clip for the new Netflix series, Dear White People, talking to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie?
Well, Lionel Higgins is a very interesting character because you don't really see him coming in a lot of instances. And particularly in this moment, which is the end of the last episode, you know, he is a journalist on campus, discovers that a family named the Hancocks are planning to donate $10 million to the school, but it's sort of in exchange for getting rid of the one black dorm on campus. And so it's not expected that he will ask like this heavy, you know, question during this town hall meeting. But what it speaks to is this, it's the complicated relationship that often, certainly, historically black colleges and universities have with white benefactors, but also just black administrators on any college campus trying to navigate the needs of their students, black students in particular, students of color in particular, and white benefactors. And it's you know,
well, and
difficult.
Also inherent in this is this question of reverse discrimination. If we're trying to integrate and live together, then why would we even want an all-black dorm? I mean, that seems to be a subtext in this. Although the larger question of what we'll do for the benefactors is certainly the big question here.
And the quick response to that is always, you know, there is specific housing for so many groups on campuses. Just as there is a black dorm, there of course obviously is a Greek dorms, right? Greek housing. So why not have a group that comes together socially and understand that that's what it is, right? It's about a certain kind of connection socially and cultural that might look raced in certain kind of ways, but not necessarily is the primary draw for that.
Right, and it's a safe space. You know, on predominantly white campuses, students of color, I mean, there have been studies done that demonstrate the need for spaces that are specific for those populations because they need support, you know, and I think it's taken for granted that you make it to a PWI, as it were, and, you know, you're going to be able to swim really well and do compete as well as everyone else, and that's not always the case. So that's another part of that conversation.
Yeah, and I think some of the complexity in understanding this is also evident in the next clip that we're about to play, and this becomes also a question about whether and when and who gets to use the N-word, and after all, are we censoring any of us who get not to use it under certain circumstances? And this becomes, you know, the centerpiece of the conversation, but there's a much larger context in terms of who is hurt and how much the pain resonates with one group over another. Let's listen to this. This features Reggie's story as well, as he confronts a white friend about saying the N-word in music.
Hey, don't say that.
What? Come on, man, you know I don't really use that word.
Yeah, man, I know, but I just really heard you say it, though.
Well, now he won't anymore. We all learned some today.
Wait, so it's bad if I'm just repeating what's in the song?
Dude, seriously?
I know. I'm sorry. But it's not like I'm a racist.
Never said you were a racist.
Just don't say nigga. Like, you didn't have to say it just then.
I guess it just felt kind of weird to censor myself.
Felt kind of weird to hear you say it. I mean, how would you feel if I started rapping the songs, you know, that say honky and cracker?
I wouldn't care at all.
Exactly. That's the difference. The fact that you don't care and I do, like, you get it?
Clip from the new Netflix series, Dear White People, Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown.
It's a classic conversation, right? The fact that it occurs in the context of them at a party listening to rap music, and given the high consumption of rap music by white kids, there are obviously many moments where young white kids find themselves uttering that phrase, that word in that kind of context. But it also speaks to issues of privilege, right? You know, we always hear this kind of combination of, well, you know, it wouldn't bother me if you said cracker or this, but, you know, those words don't hold the same kind of power that nigger holds for black folks, right? It's a totally different conversation. In fact, we're hard-pressed to think about any language that describes white folks, right? Except, unless, of course, we're talking about in a very specific ethnic ways that carries the same kind of weight of that word, right? And of course, what's so tragic about this situation is that this conversation then escalates into this other thing, right? That no one kind of expects, that was like a punch in the gut if you're watching it.
Right.
But it also speaks to that level of privilege that, you know, white kids never have to worry about these kinds of dynamics in ways that black kids do.
Right.
Yeah, because a fight breaks out, campus security comes in, immediately confronts Reggie, asks him for his ID. His ID, not the other student, both involved in the fight. Reggie's saying, why me? And the cop pulls a gun.
And almost gets killed for what we well know in terms of language in the country now, noncompliance, right? Noncompliance was going to get him killed simply because he refused to pull out his ID.
Right. And to be clear, you know, when Mark talks about privilege and the fact that there is really nothing that a black person could say that holds the same sort of power that a word like the N-word or other words that are used to degrade and demean African Americans, you know, that speaks to the fact that we have a white power structure. And so, like, the power dynamic necessitates a sensitivity to what is said, how it's said, and what it can lead to, that I don't think people always understand. But that's very, I think, apparent. I think it's part of what that scene at the party is trying to show us and demonstrate.
Because what the conversation always flips to very quickly for young white folks is, why can't I say it, right? It has nothing to do with the validity and the power of the word and the history of the word, but why do you get to say it and I don't?
Right.
Well, and since, yes, not only that, so I've lost some privilege here. There's something I can't do that you can do. Hey, let's make that right here and now.
But what does it mean to be able to do that, right? To be able to say the word nigger if you're you're black. What actual right. gain is that?
Right. And that seems to me the power of the conversation, because they're in a way they're parallel. On the one hand, we should all have the same right to use the same language. There's a kind of argument in the abstract that makes that argument true. Censorship, another very sensitive topic. You know, in this business, I hate to censor anything. You know, let the truth get out there and figure what it is. But then you have to be aware of another, the other part of this argument, which is its own conversation. And unless you engage in it and are willing to risk the pain of being wrong and stepping in the doo-doo as the white liberal, then you'll never get to the point where you didn't understand that part of the argument that you were never confronted with. And it may take a punch in the stomach for you to get it.
That's right. And I think, you know, the resistance to being politically correct that is so rampant in our culture is all about this feeling of entitlement right. to being able to say what I want to say, when I want to say it, and why can't I? And, it just, again, speaks to a lack of understanding and ignorance about just a tone deafness to the fact that there is a white power structure, that there is a system, right. there are systems in place that make it inappropriate for white people to say certain things. And, you know, it has to be understood.
And don't call me a racist, right? Because
right.
that's the other thing that comes out of it, right? Do you think that I'm some sort of redneck? No, it's not about right. that. You just can't use that word.
Right. right. And you got to understand why.
All these silos. So when Betsy DeVos, a white woman and the Secretary of Education,
right.
decides she would like to make a speech at
high
a historically black college,
yep.
why shouldn't she? Well, it turns out there were a number of students on campus who felt like they just didn't want to hear. Here she is opening her speech at Bethune-Cookman University in Daytona Beach.
Dr. Jackson, Board of Trustees, thank you so very, very much for this great honor and privilege. I am honored to become a Wildcat.
Education Secretary Betsy DeVos speaking last week at Bethune-Cookman University and HBCU. Popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown, Mark Anthony Neal. So what do you make of that, that conversation? Let's talk about that. Her reception on a campus. She's Secretary of Education. She has made some comments that it certainly would not endear her to African-American communities. I would, not the least that she considered HBCUs pioneers in school choice. But then again, you know, she's Secretary of Education.
Yeah, but okay, so what we have to parse out is the fact that she was appointed by 45, who is a president that does not understand or appreciate the legacy of historically black colleges and universities. Doesn't appreciate or understand black folks. That's number one. Number two, 45 is unwilling recently came out with a statement that questions the constitutionality of even supporting, from a financial perspective, historically black colleges and universities. And then you add to that DeVos's ignorant comment about HBCUs being pioneers of school choice when there were no choices. Mm. That's why they came into being.
Talk about missing the point.
Exactly.
Not understanding what white privilege is all about.
Exactly.
Wow.
And then to have a black president, a president of a HBCU, then invite her.
Well, that's the other question I have in all this. Right. Why on earth would an African-American university president invite Betsy DeVos?
This is the thing. When these African-American students, these black students, turn their back to Ms. DeVos, part of it is a critique of her, but it's also a critique of these institutions, right?
That's
when we talked earlier about how there's no monolithic black experience. You know, the thing that folks don't really want to wrap their heads around is that there are ways in which black folks historically have been progressive politically around race. But there's a large segment of the black community mm-hmm. that is just, quite frankly, culturally and socially conservative, if not backward.
Right.
Right. And there are many of these black institutions, again, that no one wants to talk about, that are to the right of the black church. In this context, right? So when you think about, you know, this invitation going out to Ms. DeVos, you know, folks don't realize that some of the leadership of these institutions share her politics. They share those politics, right? So this, for them, this is perfectly normal, right? Now, part of it is that they might be chasing the money, right?
Mm-hmm.
We get
yeah.
that, right? And again, there's a challenge for historically black college and universities for alumni to be able to give back at the rates that we might see at someplace like Duke or Vanderbilt or someplace, that's very real. And so they're clearly trying to do what they can do for the best of the institutions. But these people are, some of these people are fundamentally conservative, right? We see that in terms of how they think about LGBTQ issues on their campuses. We see that in terms of dress codes at places
that's
like
right.
Morehouse. And it puts black students in a double bind, right? Because as we talk about Dear White People and the experiences they're having on PWIs, then when they come to historically black colleges and universities, sometimes those aren't the safe havens they were hoping
either.
That's
right. That's right. And then add to that respectability politics where, you know, I mean, just add that to this conservatism. It becomes really baffling how schools that were created to give black students an opportunity to essentially be all that they can be, then are so really oppressed in ways that we shouldn't be seeing at the hands of black folks.
No, and I mean, to put a point on it, here's the president of the school's president, Edison O. Jackson, who had to step in at one point because the reception was so poor. Let's listen to this.
If this behavior continues, your degrees will be mailed to you.
There we go. Bethune-Cookman University President Edison O. Jackson last week, the school's commencement address. My guests are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Is there any kind of freedom? I mean, you made a clear case, Natalie, for why this may not be the right person to bring to the campus. On the other hand, what about this free speech? Should we hear from people who perhaps don't get it? Do we need to have them on campus to hear what they have to say?
Yeah, I think that there is a place for that. But it seems, at least in this example with Bethune-Cookman University, that the president made a unilateral decision. He didn't ask nobody for their advice or...
Didn't think he had to.
Right, and didn't think he had to. That's really the problem. It's not so much that this woman was invited. If people had sort of been able to weigh in on it, and especially when graduation is a day that's supposed to celebrate the students, they, at the very least, should have had some say in it. But the fact that he felt like, you know, this is something that I get to do, that's the problem.
Let's switch gears right now. Last month, rapper Kendrick Lamar released his highly anticipated album, Damn. It follows his popular 2015 album, To Pimp a Butterfly. And in Damn, Kendrick is grappling with several emotions, and also it is very introspective in a lot of ways. Songs like Love, Lust, along with Pride and Humble. And let's hear a clip from the song Fear.
I'm talking fear. Fear that my humbleness is gone. I'm talking fear. Fear that love ain't living here no more. I'm talking fear. Fear that is wickedness or weakness. Fear. Whatever it is, both is distinctive. Fear. What happens on earth stays on earth. And I can't take these feelings with me. So hopefully they disperse within 14 tracks. Carried out over wax. Searching for resolutions until somebody get back. Fear. What happens on earth stays on earth. And I can't take these feelings with me. So hopefully they disperse within 14 tracks. Carried out over wax. Wondering if I'm living through fear or living through rap.
Clip from Fear from Kendrick Lamar's recent album, Damn. My guests are Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, what's your take on this album?
So the inside baseball response.
Okay.
Aubrey Drake is killing all of these guys on the pop side, right? Most visible, selling all of these records. And then you have someone like North Carolina's own J. Cole, right, who is the anti-commercial rapper, right? And so Kendrick is in this middle space, right? How is he a successful pop artist, but at the same time still trying to stay true, you know, to the boom bap, for lack of a better way to describe it? And I think what we have with this new album, Damn, is him trying to find that middle ground, right? And part of it, I think, is ego, right? I think To Pimp a Butterfly became so much about the product, about the finished album and all the folks who contributed, that in many ways you lose sight of Kendrick in the context of that album, right? And I think that he was comfortable with that, but with this, right, it became more about him and those beats.
Well, he talks about it, too, and he talks about, Kendrick himself talks about the difference between the latest album, Damn, and To Pimp a Butterfly. Let's listen.
To Pimp a Butterfly would be the idea of the thought of changing the world, you know, and how we work and how we approach things. Down will be the idea of I can't change the world until I change myself. Mm. You know, so when you listen to records like Pride, Humble, Lust, Love, these is all just human emotions, and me looking in the mirror and coming to grips with them.
Kendrick Lamar last month on Beats One Radio and talking to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie? Well, I've got an actual question around that clip, which is, what about this? I mean, you get to a point where you're a commercial success, you're an amazing artistic success, and then there's a critique that you're inflicting us with your internal angst, as though I have to listen to what you go to sleep with at night and what you're wrestling with. You're a pop star and you're an amazing artist. Quit crying.
Yeah, but see, I think that's part of the appeal of Kendrick Lamar, because there is a vulnerability that he has that I think it stands in stark contrast to a lot of what I hear, at least in rap. And I think the fact that he's so introspective is actually, you know, something that we should applaud. But I think it attracts his listeners to him because I think we're able to sort of live vicariously and also see. I think there's something really interesting and fascinating about him dissecting himself in these ways and trying to bridge these gaps that he kind of straddles. You know, that we don't get to watch that often, and certainly in hip hop, this is kind of almost like a no-no. So he's very interesting because he embodies all these sort of contradictions that, you know, are kind of hard to resolve.
We'll take a break and talk some more about that when we come back. I'm talking with popular culture experts Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown on Back Channel. We'll talk more about that and the intersection of social justice campaigns and social media. All of that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. There's more Back Channel just ahead. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel today, connecting culture and context, talking about Kendrick Lamar's latest album, Damn. And we were, Mark, you know, just before the break, talking about this question of sort of having out loud and as part of the artistic process, the struggle between creative success and being on the front lines of a movement in some ways.
I think one of the things that's interesting about Kendrick, and we've heard it all throughout his career and all his music, right? He has some very real ambivalences about his success, where that success is going to take him and what gets left behind, you know, when he has that success. And he's also very thoughtful about his legacy within hip hop, right? So he knows what happened to Hammer, right? He knows what happened to Ja Rule, right? He knows even more complicatedly what happened to someone like Lauryn Hill in terms of the struggle of balancing this widespread appeal and still trying to be grounded and centered. And I think Damn is an attempt for him to actually find that centering piece for him, right? You know, again, the anti-commercial hip-hop recording.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, being self-conscious, not only that, but as you say, the genealogy.
Right. And someone like J. Cole has been very honest about that. Right. You know, and I think more so than Kendrick has. Right. Because I think, again, this is a generation that knows everything that came before them. They have so much more access to the previous history of these artists, and they have some very real ambivalences about what the success means for them.
Let's listen to a clip from the song Humble.
I'm so sick and tired of the Photoshop. Show me something natural like Aperol with your pride. Show me something natural. I want to feel some stretch marks. Then to take you down right on your mama couch in polo sock. Hey, this is way too crazy. Hey, you do not amaze me. Hey, I blew cool from AC.
That's from the song Humble, Kendrick Lamar's. That's from the recent album Damn. And I'm talking with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, that song got him into a little bit of hot water in the sense that he's talking for some kind of naturalness, like I don't need all the makeup and things. But on the other side, it got him in some hot water with the feminist.
Yeah, I think, from Kendrick's perspective, I think he was trying to be affirming and, you know, to sort of uplift the naturalista. But what he got in trouble for was the fact that, you know, there is a beauty standard that is imposed and projected on Black women where, you know, we feel a certain pressure to meet the standard, and we do various things to our faces and our hair in order to meet that, and then to be told that, you know, actually, I want you to go back. Like, I don't want you to do that. I want you to do this. You know, it sort of underscores the fact that the beauty standard is a male construction, right? It's something that comes from men. The conversation around beauty often is one that when women talk about how they feel about the standard, you know, they're told not to complain, shut up, sit down, and all these things. So that's where he sort of missed the mark. I don't think he didn't quite catch the nuances of what he was saying.
Well, it gets back to our conversation about Dear White People and sort of how white liberals want to fit in the picture and when you can overstep your bounds or not understand where this is not your territory, or at least not that particular expression would be appropriate.
Yeah.
Well, let me flip that a different way, because I think very early on, so much of the conversation was actually directed by white woman's cultural critics, right, who was like, okay, you need to be out of this conversation. But, you know, Ninth Wonder and I had a very spirited conversation with the young women in our class, our history of hip-hop class, around this video, right? And part of it has to do with, you know, we're talking to 19, 20, 21-year-olds, right, who are really invested, particularly around things like social media and Instagram in terms of the imaging of themselves. Ninth Wonder and I are grown-ass men, right? And so we interpreted the video very differently, because when we saw this image, what we heard was, I'm absolutely fine.
Yeah.
With who you are without all these adornments, right? You know, when that line about the stretch marks, right? I mean, there's not a grown black woman who doesn't have stretch marks, right? That doesn't have all kinds of anxieties about this. And what Kendrick's is saying is that I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
Right. I'm cool the way you are. So it speaks to a kind of generational divide, but also, again, this male-female thing. We hear reports all the time that women, black women's perceptions of their bodies are often very different than the way that black men perceive those bodies and what black men desire out of those bodies, right?
Right.
And that doesn't mean that even if black men are saying, I like the way you are, that that isn't imposing a privileged perspective on that, right?
Right, right, right.
Well, you talked about Ninth Wonder, who's a producer on this album. He actually produced the song Duckworth. And before we hear that song, maybe you can give us some context for this track. But our North Carolina's own Ninth is a producer on this.
So on To Pimp a Butterfly, Ninth Wonder's artist, Rhapsody, who's on his label Jamla and now Jamrock, because she signed a distribution deal with Jay-Z's label. Kendrick, she was on Kendrick's last album. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, Ninth and I don't talk a whole lot about the inside business. But he gives me a call about 3 weeks before the album's coming. I was like, yo, Neil, guess what? Right? And so he explains to me some of the history, the fact that, you know, some time ago, I mean, years ago, he gave Kendrick, you know, 10 beats. And Kendrick said, I'm going to do something with it, right? And, you know, you just kind of, right? And you know, Ninth had actually offered the beats to some other folks. And finally, you know, Kendrick hits him back, you know, about 4 or 5 months ago, shows a video clip playing one of the beats. Doesn't say much else, right? And then finally, you know, shortly before the album comes out, you know, they want clearances, you know, and all those, and you know, the rest is kind of history.
Great stuff. And it's an interesting the story, too, because it turns out that he's talking about Kendrick. His dad and his label boss actually met, but under circumstances that let's listen to the clip.
Ducky was well aware. They robbed the manager and shot a customer last year. He figured he'd get on these good sides. Free chicken every time Anthony posted in line. 2 extra biscuits. Anthony liked them and then let them slide. They didn't kill him. In fact, it looked like they're the last to survive. Pay attention, that one decision changed both of their lives. One curse at a time, reverse to manifest a good karma, and I tell you why. You take 2 strangers and put them in random predicaments. Give them a soul so they can make their own choices and live with it. 20 years later, them same strangers you make them meet again. Inside recording studios where they reaping their benefits. Then you start reminding them about that chicken incident. Whoever thought the greatest rapper would be from coincidence? Because if Anthony killed Ducky, Top Dog could be serving life while I grow up without a father and die in a gunfight.
Duckworth, Kendrick Lamar's most recent album, Damn, and that is one of the records on there, produced by Ninth Wonder from Durham, North Carolina. And the reference there is to the head of his label, who was a long time ago held up, the KFC, where his father was working, and he's suggesting that things could have turned out very differently.
You know, there's a way in which living in mixed-race, interracial communities are great things. But one of the real beauties of living in segregated black community is that you actually get generations within those spaces. And one of the things that's the beauty of living with older black folks, you know, you'll have these narratives where, you know, there's some cats in the community who don't really do nothing. That when you go to work in the morning, they're there. When you come home in the evening, they're there. But you have these stories of older black women who knew that when they came home on Friday after payday, those dudes that were there when you left, right, you buy them a 40, right? You know, you buy them and they're good. And what that means is that not only will no one else in the community harm you, not only will they not harm you, but they will protect you from other folks, right? And this is what, you know, Kendrick's dad understood. Let me just slide this dude a couple of biscuits and a couple of extra pieces and we're good, right? And that is exactly what saved his life.
I'm going to switch gears here and talk about the intersection of social media and social justice. Natalie, tell us about the campaign hashtag Raise the Age and how that's being used as a platform for sharing information and narratives.
So for some years now, North Carolina and New York have been the only two states in America to prosecute 16-year-olds and older as adults. And so the Raise the Age campaign has sought to change that so that 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, and possibly even 18-year-olds are tried as juveniles. And there's all kinds of, you know, evidence that this would save money. It certainly would be better for the young people, you know, but there it's been a hard fought fight. So recently, New York has decided to change the age, and North Carolina seems to be moving in that direction, but it's been a fight.
Well, it also suggests, Mark, this kind of the new role of not very new, but the role of hashtag activism in popular culture. How do you see it progressing, and both in terms of its scope, but also effectiveness?
I think we're starting to see the transformation of it, right? I mean, one of the whole point of an hashtag is to be able to spread the word about a particular thing. So now you have folks around the country that are connected to issues that they would have normally never been connected to, and a hashtag allows them to actually index emerging information from that. So I think we're seeing now, we see it in Black Lives Matter, where they're now making that transformation from just acknowledging what's going on to actually thinking about real policy reactions. I mean, just this past weekend when we saw all the movements around bailing out black mothers, right, who can't afford to pay the bails, right? The, you know, the idea of transforming bail money from simply being about cash to some other form, you know, so that folks who, you know, are suffering economically will be able to get out of jail and be the parents that they need to be, the mothers that they need to be for their children.
I was just going to add that, you know, Say Her Name is another hashtag campaign, and, you know, it seeks to bring to light and make people aware of the fact that there are black women who are being, black women and girls really, who are being, you know, who have lost their lives at the hands of law enforcement. We kind of know the names of people like Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, and so forth, and we need to know their names. But Say Her Name really hopes to make people understand that, you know, it's not just black men that are being victimized by law enforcement, but there have been 70 black women over the past 3 years who have lost their lives to law enforcement. And so we need to be able to hear their names and know who they are
And it's a response to the hashtag Say His Name, which brought attention to those. So let's listen to activist Kimberly Crenshaw talk about the mission behind it.
Say Her Name was a literal demand that then became part of a hashtag campaign in order to ensure that the movement against police brutality actually does include all of the black bodies that are subject to police violence. In realizing that if we're going to demand that people say her name, then people need to know the names to say. And in reality, the information about black women being killed by the police was very difficult to find. There is no national database of all people killed by the police, much less African-American women killed by the police.
Civil rights activist Kimberly Crenshaw talking about her work in the Say Her Name campaign. I'm talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. I want to switch gears again and talk about a new portion of Back Channel where we hear from Mark and Natalie about current pop culture picks. Natalie, you have your pick this month is a play called Venus. I want to hear a clip from Venus.
Have you heard about the rump she has, though strange it be? Large as a cauldron pot. This is why men go to see the Venus Hottentot.
The Venus Hottentot.
Yeah, there's a clip from the play Venus, Natalie Bullock Brown. Tell us what that where that connection is made.
Well, so Venus is actually a real woman named Sarah Bartman who lived in South Africa, or is a South African woman who was alive at the end of the 18th century and early 19th century, and she was famous or became famous because she was essentially exploited by her white male handler, someone she worked for in South Africa, who took her to Europe and basically made a show of her, created a essentially a freak show, like a circus around her and her body, because Sarah... one characteristic of her was a large behind. And so European audiences had never seen a black woman or anyone with a behind that large. And so, you know, she was a spectacle, and she was actually allowed to be touched at the end of her shows to make sure that she was actually real. So it's really sort of tragic history that I'm interested in excavating more of because of a documentary that I'm working on that includes Sarah Bartman. But also, I think it speaks to the ways that even today, black women are objectified and hypersexualized because of their anatomy. And so it's very, I think, timely.
And that clip satirizes, of course, that situation.
Yes.
Mark Anthony Neal, pop culture pick, what should we be looking for?
You know, I've just started reading. I actually just finished Mike Eric Dyson's Tears We Cannot Stop, a sermon to white America. And you know, Professor Dyson is very prolific, has written many books. What surprised me about this book, you know, it going back to the dear white people moment, right, is that he refers to white people throughout the book as my beloved. And he set up the book in the context of a church service. So even while there are ways in which of it that seems very structured, he's beaten folks upside the head quite a bit,
no doubt,
you know, throughout the book. But one of the things that's surprising, he's also, you know, using personal narrative in there, you know, parts of him that folks don't really know about in terms of his own confrontations with so-called black on black violence, his own confrontations with law enforcement, the challenges of being a working class single father on welfare, you know, who's transformed himself into this person that we know, you know, as we know him. I think it's so important to have a moment with so many stories being told. We actually do have very few stories, memoirish stories of older black, you know, that kind of 50-plus African-American men talking very honestly about the challenges of parenting and relationships. We tend to think of those kinds of books as being solely directed, written by women and directed towards women. So it's actually nice to see a grown African-American man, you know, talk about some of those experiences, even as he's calling white supremacy into question.
Mark and Natalie, always a pleasure. We'll do it again next month, shall we?
Yes.
Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark is a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke University, the author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Natalie Bullock Brown, a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh and an Emmy-nominated producer and filmmaker. You can find out more about their work and our show at our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up on our next episode of Movies on the Radio, the best or worst remake. Think King Kong, Scarface, or The Parent Trap. Let us know what you think and be a part of the show. SOT at WNC.org or tweet at us using hashtag SOTMovie. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Norman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.